For those of you that are here, we're going to spend some time today in 1 Corinthians 7, really one of the longest chapters in the book of 1 Corinthians. Now, these chapter divisions are not something that are inspired. They were added later. And there is a story that said that a lot of these chapter divisions were done by a Frenchman who would actually create these chapter divisions as he was riding on his horse. And so you have some chapters that are a little too short. You wonder if the horse stumbled, and then some were too long, maybe got preoccupied. But this one will take us a while to go through, but it really helps us understand a number of very important things, as we'll put on the screen here. First of all, we're talking about the ancient city of Corinth. And especially next week, when we get into the whole issue of meat sacrificed idols and everything, this actual diagram of what it looks like will help you understand why Paul brought this up and how these individuals were really addressing a moral issue. But right now we're talking about some other moral issues. And really the theme, as you can see in the handout, is that Jesus desires that we serve him both in our vocation and relationships. Up until now, we've seen that chapter 6, 1 through 6 has been a little bit critical. It's a little more militaristic, a little bit more confrontative, if you will. And so it ends with this statement that we looked at last time, glorify God in your body. So now chapter 7 really picks up on that, and number 1 talks about how you can glorify God in terms of your sexuality. And number 2, how you can glorify God in terms of your vocation and calling. And his first 6 chapters I've already alluded to are kind of stern, but now he's moving to more of a pastoral tone, in part because he recognizes that they really need to be instructed. And now that they've been rebuked for some of their behavior, he now is providing, if you will, pastoral instruction for what takes place. So we're going to look at the first 16 verses of chapter 7, so follow along with me if you might. Now concerning the matters about which you spoke, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. But because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another except perhaps by agreement for a limited time that you may devote yourselves to prayer, but then come together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Then in verse 6, now as a concession, not a command, I say this, I wish that all were as I myself am, but each has his own gift from God, one of one kind and one of another. To the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am, but if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry. It is better to marry than to burn with passion. To the married, I give this charge, not I, but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband. If she does, she should remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to her husband, and the husband should not divorce his wife. To the rest I say, and not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she contends to live with him, he should not divorce her. If a woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Otherwise your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace. For how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband, or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? Quite a lot of things going on there, but obviously what Paul is trying to do is begin to address this issue of marriage in a culture that obviously had its values inverted. If you think about that, what we looked at last week in chapter 6 was the fact that they were dealing with some incredibly bizarre kinds of sexuality. And this week, you know, I go on to YouTube every once in a while, as perhaps you do as well, and sometimes it will recommend something. And either because I had done a search on this or something else, it was recommending some videos by some historians about Rome. And I, this week, had an even more eye-opening experience about how decadent Greece, how decadent decadent Rome, and in particular how decadent Corinth is. So much so, I couldn't even say most of this in mixed company, and certainly would not say it in church. So any of the most bizarre things you can possibly imagine, even things that, even though I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, might have caused a few people in San Francisco to say, whoa, that's even more for than for us, to take place was the case. And so as I put on the screen here, if it was difficult for the Corinthians to see that engaging in prostitution was wrong, because as I point out, sometimes in these various dinners for dessert, a prostitute would be offered. I mean, it's just as bizarre as some of the things that actually happened in Corinth. So if this is your mindset, you can see that if they didn't understand that prostitution was wrong, then how much more difficult would it be to navigate the sexual nuances and expectations of marriage? So now after he's criticized them in chapter 6, he realizes that they so are off base in terms of their biblical idea of sexuality, he's going to now provide some general principles for marriage. They were very indulgent, hedonistic, sinful in their practices, and so in many cases what was happening, and you're going to see a little diagram I'm going to have up here of a pendulum swing, because some swing so far to one extreme, then you had others that swing all the way to the other extreme, and you see this in one of the first verses. It's good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. So what you had is, because there were some who were looking at the decadent, sensual, hedonistic actions in the Corinthian culture, there were others we're actually saying was never permissible for a man to have sexual interaction with a woman. So you have this kind of pendulum swing that's taking place. So I put this little diagram up there just to remind you that on both sexuality and vocations, you have this incredible reaction, which sometimes is typical if you think about it in terms of the way the church does. We see something opposite, and so then we go to the complete opposite, the other direction. And so what he's trying to do in some cases here is to address the ascetic group in the midst of all this pagan decadence and prostitution, all the rest. There were then some in the church that were actually saying that sex inside of marriage is only maybe permissible for procreation, and that actually most people should never have sex at all. So they were the ascetic group. And so while it was correct for these believers to avoid the sexual norms of the culture, Paul's trying to provide them with some kind of balanced biblical view on the issue of sexuality. And so we see this pendulum swing. So against the two extremes, on the one hand, pagan hedonism, on the other hand, religious asceticism, he offers kind of a balanced view of sexuality. In this, he maintains that married couples should engage in sexual activity regularly unless they're in a period of fasting. We might look at that and go, well, of course, but in that culture, because of the false messages happening inside the church, he's trying to, again, try to recognize that each wing of the pendulum is wrong and try to help them understand that. Here's something else that's intriguing. You begin to find out, and I hate to say this, women, but in the first century Corinth, women had really no rights to speak of, and even rights in terms of their sexual experiences. So it was a culture which was known for depriving women of consent in sexual encounters. I won't get too gross here, but it turns out that when later there was a law in Rome against adultery, what the Romans decided to do, and the Greeks followed suit, especially since they actually worshipped the cult of Bacchus, was to say that then you have a right to have sex with any slave, because slaves had the status of kind of furniture in the Roman culture. And thus you had rights, men had any kind of rights, because the father had a right over whether or not he was even going to allow the child to live or die. Sometimes the child would be born, and if he did not pick up the child, they would throw it out on the street. I mean, again, this is how awful the culture is. And if you'd like to read a good book, one of the professors at Baylor University, Rodney Stark, has written a series of books over the years talking about how Christianity gave us the world that we're in. But in there, spends a fair amount of time talking about what it was like to live in Rome and in Greece, in infanticide and sexual promiscuity and all the rest. And so Paul, in the midst of this culture, says, wait a minute. A man certainly does not have complete rights, because after all, he does not own his own body. Your body was bought with a price, so the wife has a right over the man, the man has a right over the woman. And so this was something, again, to just clarify some of the complete miscommunication and misunderstanding that was happening in the world. There are whole verses that and whole sermons that have been preached on these first seven verses, but I'm going to keep the train moving and come to the one statement here about a concession. And you see this in verse 6, because here now he makes a concession, and that is that he talks about the possibility that there may be some who, again, perhaps were practicing this ascetic view of marriage in which they would actually fast. They would have a fast from food. They would have a fast from sex. And so what he goes on to say is that indeed one of the concessions he would make is that if there was a mutually agreed upon period of abstinence, that is permitted. He's not commanding it in any sense, but he is taking a moment to kind of ward off some of the misconception again in Corinth. If you talk about a culture that has got all the values inverted, that's Corinth. As we look around our culture today, we see a lot of those same values being inverted. So this is a passage here that once again reminds us of how important using biblical principles might be. Then starting from those verses in verse 8 and following, he then gives us a few other statements. But in his concession, let me just help you understand that he also talks about making and staying single may be a thing to continue. Staying married as well is that. And so now he begins to address from verses 8 to 16 some of the other marital situations, and he deals with some of those in particular that are applicable to us today. Following this, he says the primary instruction are for the unmarried, the widows, and those who are contemplating a divorce to simply remain faithful in their current situations in light of the teaching of Jesus. In verses 8 and 9, for example, it says if an unmarried person or a widow desires to remarry, you are permitted to do so, but staying in his or her current state is to be preferred for a number of reasons, which we'll talk about in a section we're going to read in just a minute. However, if one cannot remain pure in singleness, one lacks the gift of singleness, then it's better to marry. And then he shifts his focus then to this issue that I want to talk about in our application section in just a minute, this issue of divorce. And that is, he talks about believers who are married to other believers in verse 10. He then says that the argument is no divorce. And it uses different words for separate and divorce. And some will say that separation means separation, divorce means divorce, but I think more and more commentators are saying separate and divorce is really essentially the same thing. But the ultimate goal here, and we're going to look at some verses related to divorce in just a minute, is reconciliation as a way to begin to once again model before this unbelieving Corinthian world what it really means to be a Christian. And really to be chaste, to be abstinent, to then have fidelity in marriage and not to divorce would cause you to so stand out in the Corinthian culture that the idea is that it would provide opportunities for evangelism. Because people would say, you are so different than anything else I see in this culture. And as a result, we could see how effective that was in terms of turning the Corinthian culture around because of the faithful obedience of believers. If you're worried about changing the culture today, again, we need to be good models before the watching world. Then he talks about to the rest. That's in verse 12. Over here he talks about to the rest. And here he's talking about those who are married to unbelievers. And I've done whole radio programs over the years, books that have been written by women talking about how to encourage a woman who's a Christian married to a non-Christian man and vice versa. And here, a lot of that is based upon these passages. And he said, if a Christian is married to someone who is without the faith, the believer is to remain faithful to Jesus' views on marriage and divorce. As the believer in marriage lives a God-honoring life, the hope is that she would be then a witness to her husband and her children. And that's what he's talking about here in terms of holiness. Then he talks about this idea of sanctifying, or in some of your translations it might be making holy. There's implying as long as the unbeliever remains in marriage, the potential is for his or her salvation remains as he or she watches the lifestyle of the believer. And of course, we've all perhaps had stories of individuals where the wife becomes a Christian and then eventually the husband becomes a Christian. Or the wife becomes a Christian and the husband never really becomes a Christian, but at least the children children are influenced by this. So again, the idea is if a marriage between a believer and unbeliever ends, it should be due to the actions of the unbelieving partner. The believing partner should remain faithful to Jesus and the views, again, of marriage and divorce. So marriage to the believer is not about the benefits that you can receive, but instead reflecting the very commitment of Christ that made to the church. Because after all, we are the bride for Christ. So he's using this as the same illustration which we see in Ephesians 4 and 5. While other marriages would break down at the point of spiritual disagreement, the idea is the believer remains and instead represents God's unconditional and steadfast commitment to his people. If you think about this in the New Testament, you can all the way go back to the Old Testament and think of Hosea and some of the other examples there and the opportunity that might exist. But I'm keeping it moving because now we're going to look at the longest passage of the longest chapter in the First Corinthians. So it'll take a while to read through. So let's, if we can, start in verse 17. Only let each person lead the life that the Lord has assigned to him and to which God has called him. This is my rule in all the churches. Was anyone at the time of his call already circumcised? Let him not seek to remove the marks of circumcision. Was anyone at the time of his call uncircumcised? Let him not seek circumcision. For neither circumcision counts for anything nor uncircumcision, but keeping the commandment of God. Each one should remain in the condition of which he was called. Were you a slave when you were called? Were you not concerned about it? But if you gain your freedom, avail yourself of the opportunity. For he who was called in the Lord as a slave is a freedman of the Lord. Likewise, he was free when called is a slave of Christ. You were bought with a price. Do not become slaves of men. So brothers, in whatever condition each was called, there let them and him remain with God. Then he goes on in verse 25. Now concerning the betrothed, I have no commandment from the Lord, but I give my judgment as one who is, by the Lord's mercy, is trustworthy. I think that in the view of the present distress, it is good for a person to remain as he is. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be free. Are you free from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you do marry, you have not sinned, and if a betrothed woman marries, she has not sinned. Yet those who marry will have worldly troubles, and I would spare you that. This is what I mean, brothers. The appointed time has grown very short. From now on, let those who have wives live as though they had none, and those who mourn as though they are not mourning, and those who rejoice as those who are not rejoicing, and those who buy as though they have no goods, and those who deal with the world as though they had no dealings with it, for the present form of this world is passing away. Then verse 32. I want you to be free from anxieties. The unmarried man is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to please the Lord, but the married man is anxious about worldly things, how to please his wife, and his interests are divided. And the unmarried or betrothed woman is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to be holy in body and spirit. But the married woman is anxious about the worldly things, how to please her husband. I say this for your own benefit, not to lay any restraint upon you, but to promote good order and to secure your undivided devotions to the Lord. If anyone thinks that he is not behaving properly towards his betrothed, if his passions are strong and has to be, let him do as he wishes. Let them marry. It is no sin. But whoever is firmly established in his heart, being under no necessity, is having his desire under control and determined this to be his in his heart, to keep her as his betrothed, he will do well. So then, he who marries his betrothed does well, and he who refrains from marriage will do even better. A wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives, but if the husband dies, she is free to be married to whom she wishes only in the Lord. Yet in my judgment, she is happier if she remains as she is, and I think that too has the Spirit of God. So here Paul is giving some advice, not necessarily claiming that it has apostolic authority, but nevertheless gives his kind of perspective. And what we begin to see here in verses 7 and chapter 7 and following is not only a look at your calling, but also once again returning back to this issue of marriage. And many in the church in Corinth assume that once you became a Christian, then you also had to change your calling. Now that might be true. Let's imagine if you were a prostitute and you became a Christian. Let's imagine if you were involved in temple worship and you became a Christian. Obviously you need to change your vocation. But in many cases there was this idea that once I'm a Christian, I need to now go into an entirely different vocation. And so as a result, this was again one of the issues he was dealing with in the church. And he reminds them that the gospel alone gives them identity, so they shouldn't necessarily get their identity by what they do or where they work, but by who they are as a follower of Jesus Christ. And so again, once again, we can see this pendulum swing. We had some that were so involved in their work that they got their identity from their work. We had others that said, because I became a Christian, I've got to completely change my line of work. And what he's once again trying to do is deal with this pendulum swing tendency, which we saw in Corinth, and I sometimes think we see even in our modern day, because the gospel makes it very clear that we're equal before the eyes of the Lord, and whether circumcised or uncircumcised, whether in a godly profession or a quote secular profession, that's the case. Christ works through the believer, and actually changing callings after conversion only proves that you're concerned more about the approval of men than God. And so there were individuals that would be working in a shop. They might be selling leather goods. They might have been selling fruit. They might have been selling jewelry. They might have been working on the docks and helping those individuals getting off the ships. And that might have been one of those things where they said, well, now that I'm a Christian, I really need to be doing churchy types of things, you know, maybe feeding other Christians. And so he's trying to say, no, all kinds of professions can be used of the Lord. And so like sexuality, the Corinthians swung between these two extremes of calling and vocation. One viewed that the upward mobility in the career was all that mattered. And so they'd say, well, yeah, I'm just going to use this now to become the treasurer, as Erastus did, or one of the leaders there. Others held to this view that you should change or escape from your current vocation. And later, this leads to almost kind of the monastic ideas that you see there. I know that Pastor Graham today talked about the trip that they're going to take to Greece. And when you go to Corinth, just before you get there, there is a place where for many years they've been all these monasteries, and they're all up in these caves, they're up in these areas, because the idea is we just need to separate from the world. And even the whole monastic movement came out from the idea that, well, if you're a Christian, you're called to a higher calling, so you'll separate from the world. Paul's not saying that. Matter of fact, what they found is when they separate from the world and they get in the monastery, sin still followed them because people are still sinful. You know, the worldliness that they thought they were escaping from still comes with those individuals. And here, he's really reminding them that God can use them whatever they are doing, whatever calling they might have. And so his instruction here is to find this balance. Their temporary vocation should not be something to escape from, nor something to idolize, but instead to recognize that they engage diligently every day with God. At the end here, I'm going to do an application on divorce, but I could just as easily do one on vocation, so we might do that in future weeks, because what does the Bible have to say about our jobs and about our vocation and our calling? So we'll use one of these passages later on to come back to that topic. But then in verses 25 and following, he circles around to the topic he already addressed earlier. He was talking about marriage and some other issues, but now he talks about this issue of remaining as it relates to those who are betrothed. And in contrast to verse 10, he mentions that he has no scriptural words from Jesus about this. So in some respects, Paul's saying, what I told you before comes from Jesus. It has apostolic authority, but now I'm just going to give you my advice, which I think is kind of helpful. But even as he gives you advice, he's certainly giving his opinion, but it shouldn't be taken lightly. And here, the church could decide for or against this instruction, but it's something he's given to the church in Corinth, and I still think it has some common sense principles we can apply today. Now, when he talks about betrothed or virgins, it's not clear, but it's for somehow we obviously are talking about single people. And his opinion for single people is to remain single, although he recognizes that this is just simply his opinion rather than a Christian mandate. And the reason he does this, let's go back to verse 26 here, because he says, I see this in view of the present distress. I've read over that over the years, but again, when you write and you study and you prepare a Sunday school lesson, you learn some things you didn't know. And I always wonder what that present distress was. Well, we don't have anything in Scripture that tells us, but we do have something in history. Turns out that as Paul writes this to the church in Corinth, there was a famine that was taking place. It hit Corinth about AD 51, and that's about the time in which he wrote this letter. So it is quite possible that Paul is saying, you know, you might be wise to remain single because we're in the midst of a famine. Now, some people have even said that maybe Paul thought this famine was an end time event. In other words, this famine may be a foreshadowing of the return of Christ. We now look back and say, no, that wasn't the case. But it also illustrates how sometimes when we have an economic downturn, everybody says, well, I better not get married, or I better not invest in this business, because after all, Christ could return. And of course, Christ can return. He could return before the end of our Sunday school class this morning. But Christ could also return 1,000 years from now. And so I think what he is helping them understand is that in the midst of this distress, you might want to think and use some common sense about whether or not getting married. And what's the issue with getting married? Well, getting married in Corinth would mean that you would be setting up a household. You would be leaving your family's house. You'd be setting up your other household. So there were expenses involved there, which would be oftentimes very difficult and very painful during this time of famine. And then because there was no birth control, that's another thing I saw in this YouTube video, all the different ways in which Romans and Greek people tried to practice birth control, none of them were effective. Now recognize that in the Roman world, a woman oftentimes would get married at the age of 13. So you recognize that very quickly you have what today we would call a teenager possibly having to raise children, certainly during those teen years. You can kind of play that out for just a minute and see why Paul's saying this might not be the wisest thing to do in the midst of a famine. And so I think this present crisis, if we understand that, maybe helps us understand why Paul was saying, you know, think through, use some godly wisdom and discernment before you get married, which is good no matter whether you're 13 or 35, right? You know, you got to think through some of those issues. To Paul, both singleness and marriage are gifts, but in the singleness in this present crisis, that's why he was saying maybe this would be preferred. Then it also was pointed out that single people do not have to divide their time, because we see this as well, because if you are married, then a husband obviously needs to please his wife. Doesn't mean he's not pleasing God, but you do have a little more divided loyalty, especially in terms of time and resources and focus, especially during this time of famine. And so you can see that he was really addressing a number of those very insignificant issues. So with that, let me, if I can, do an application. For those of you that are new to the class, one of the things I like to do is cover some of the material that the church encourages to cover, and then use many times what we are studying to get us into some other topics that are certainly relevant. Because I certainly love the fact that when you're talking about God's Word, it forces you. I love it. The one thing that's good about expository preaching is it forces you into this. A couple of weeks ago, when I say, yeah, let's talk about divorce today in the first Sunday in December, probably not. But did it take us there? Yes, it did. And this is something that I wanted to address for just a few minutes. I know we've had people in this class that have been divorced, and I want, if nothing else, to be kind of thinking about what should the church do in the 21st century with this issue of divorce. But first of all, let's look at some of the biblical passages and talk about how the church can minister to those of you that have been divorced or friends that you know that have been divorced that are really dealing with some of those issues. Two passages in the Old Testament, if you want to put those in your notes. One very lengthy passage in the book of Deuteronomy, and that's not something we usually study in our quiet times too often, but nevertheless, in Deuteronomy 24, which is important because Jesus is asked about that, and just we're going to look at that in just a minute. In Deuteronomy 24, we see that Moses puts this down in this particular passage. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he was found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends it out from his house. So in just a minute, we're going to see that Jesus was asked about that because it did give permission for divorce. Now, at the time in which Jesus preached, you had two very different schools of thought, the Hillel school and the other school. One which would say that this was indecency, this would be sexual immorality, of the kinds of things that might have happened in Corinth. But there was another school that was a much more liberal towards divorce school that said if you just burned your bagel, that was enough to send her off. And so Jesus is being asked this. We'll look at this in just a minute in the book of Matthew. But before we get there, it's important to understand that there were differing divisions even within the Jewish culture about how that applied. Which is why I think it's helpful that we see in the book of Malachi, it says that God hates divorce. So that it establishes the fact that God's intention was a man and a woman leaving and cleaving their father and mother and communicating love, sexual intimacy, and a desire for children for life. That was the ideal. But of course, then you have had in the Old Testament culture divorce. And then in the New Testament, you have Jesus confronted by these issues. And so the question is, well, is divorce permissible? And we see this in Matthew 5. And here Jesus said, it was said, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. And he already has explained that this was done because Moses recognized the hardness of your heart. So he goes on to say, but I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife except for the reason of unchastity makes her commit adultery. Whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. And so he instead raises the standard in a way that all the Pharisees and the scribes and the Sadducees had never anticipated. And all through the book of Matthew, especially in the Sermon on the Mount and other places, you see Jesus will say, you've heard it said, now I say to you. I mean, he takes on some of these false Jewish ideas, and begins to establish the standard. And the standard is what? Well, the standard is a man and woman for life. But at the same time, divorce sometimes takes place for certain reasons. And so what we find is that there are all sorts of debates. And I remember in the days I used to teach at Dallas Theological Seminary, sometimes in a doctorate of ministry class or something like that, we get involved in these kinds of debates. And I'd let the debates go on for a little while. And then finally, I'd say, okay, you know, some people say there's no excuse. There are some excuses. There are many excuses, whatever. And then I would, of course, take him to this passage, which we've just looked at, to the married, I give instructions, not I, but the Lord, that the wife should not leave her husband, but if she does leave, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and that the husband should not divorce his wife, but to the rest I say, not the Lord, but if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he must not divorce her. And a woman who has an unbelieving husband and she consents to live with her, she should not send her husband away. And so I say to them, okay, we recognize that even when we look at these few verses that deal with divorce, the reality is simply this. Most people in your churches, when I'm talking to pastors, or most people that will be in the churches that you'll be teaching in when I talk to seminary students, have lots of people that have been divorced for all sorts of other reasons besides biblical reasons. What are you going to do about that? And it sort of changed the whole discussion, because they can have these intramural discussions about this, but would you not agree that many of the people in your church have been divorced for reasons that aren't necessarily biblical? But now, how do we minister to them? And in the old days when I used to teach, I'm just old enough to remember, when I first started teaching on that, I heard the pronoun this. What should we do about those divorced people outside the church? But over time, I began to hear more and more people saying, what should we do about divorced people inside the church? And I said, you know, we need to now start thinking about whether we're going to have things like divorce care, whether we're going to minister to individuals, and really begin to address some of those issues. And the reason I saw this taking place is because what happened is something remarkable in American history. We've always had some divorces in America, but this chart will give you the number of divorces per 100 married women. By the way, a lot of this is one of the books we're giving away today, by the way, to any guests that's here, Christian Ethics in Plain Language. But, you know, we used to have a divorce which is relatively rare, but by the late 1960s, really from about 1968 to 1980, the divorce rate doubled in just about a decade. Now, the divorce rate among Christians has a lag time, so that's when I saw things happening in the 80s, when it already happened in the culture. Now, when people looked at that, they thought, well, this must be due to a lot of people that have married a long time and finally decided to throw in the towel after the kids went off to college. No, they found something different. That is, this was not a divorce rate that was increasing among those who were the builder generation, those born before the end of World War II. This was a divorce rate due to the fact that those after that, the baby boom generation, then the baby bust generation, others, there, most of the divorces came from there. And so as a result, the divorce rate changed dramatically in a couple of ways. First of all, that sharp increase was due in large part to attitude. I've written about this in other books as well, because baby boomers were less dedicated to marriage fidelity than their parents were. And so as a result, they were less committed. So first of all, the divorce rate began to go up, but then something else happened politically. We had what were called no-fault divorce laws, starting in places like Oklahoma, California, and everywhere, and eventually every state has no-fault divorce, which means you can get divorced for any reason or no reason at all. And so you saw this tremendous increase in divorce rate taking place from the late 1960s to the 1980s. There was a second opportunity as well, and that is economic opportunity for women, which was a good thing. Women for the first time actually were going out into the workforce, had an opportunity to pursue their own careers, but because they did, much less likely to stay in a difficult marriage. And so because of both attitude and opportunity, we could see that what was happening is divorces were increasing dramatically. What's so intriguing, if we look at this diagram, is you can see it beginning to decline in the 1980s. And a lot of people said, oh, well, maybe we are not moving into a divorce culture. Well, when they went back and looked at it, it wasn't that divorces were going down that much. It is that fewer and fewer people were deciding to get married. If I'd had more time, I would have talked about both divorce and cohabitation. You know, less than just a few percentages of all individuals were living together in the 1950s, and now cohabitation's gone off the charts, you know, and so you had more and more children being born to unwed mothers. So it wasn't that divorce was going down, wasn't that our attitude about divorce was changing, it was actually that fewer and fewer people were getting married, fewer people tying the knot. So as a result, this is why I thought it would be important for just a minute to think about how can we as the church, and how has the church already begun to minister to all the people dealing with this issue of divorce. And I thought I'd start with a quote from Diane Medved. You may know who Michael Medved is. He's a talk show host, been on my program a couple of times, very articulate. Diane Medved is just as brilliant as he is. And she wrote in one of her books this: I have to start with a confession. This isn't the book I set out to write. I plan to write something consistent with my previous professional experience helping people with decision making. I thought that striking down taboos about divorce was another part of the ongoing enlightenment of the women's civil rights and human potential movements of the last 25 years. I've kept whole sections out here because this goes on for almost two pages. But anyway, she ends this section by saying, to my utter befuddlement, the extensive research I conducted for this book brought me to one inescapable and irrefutable conclusion. I had been wrong. And she titled her book, The Case Against Divorce. And so for just a few minutes, I want to talk about some of the reasons that I want to and have been giving to pastors why, when they are counseling couples that are considering divorce, to really think carefully about what they're going to do. Because this is a classic example, which we see every once in a while, that just as we start to learn a little bit more about a social issue, then we legalize it. We're seeing this right now. We're starting to learn more and more about the dangers of smoking marijuana at the very time when we have more and more states legalizing marijuana. And in the same thing, we didn't have the kind of studies I'm going to quote in just a minute back in the 1960s and 70s when we actually implemented no-fault divorce, and now we know a lot more about it. So if you have actually been through a divorce, there'll be times when you're going to say, check, check, oh yeah, I completely agree with that. But more importantly, these are the kinds of things that I would hope pastors would be able to share with individuals that are convinced that the only answer to their emotional problems right now is divorce. And maybe even begin to cause others that have thinking that divorce is the only answer to their current unhappiness, that they may bring on all sorts of other issues as well. So let's look at just a couple of those. Some of the studies that I'm going to quote from come from individuals who, again, could not possibly have signed the doctrinal statement of Prestonwood Baptist Church. Judith Wallerstein, a Jewish, pretty much of a secular Jew, did an ongoing study in Marin County in Northern California of divorce. And again, just like Diane Medved and others, began to realize the incredible consequences of divorce. By the way, for those of us that are parents and grandparents, this is the kind of stuff you want to pass on to your children and grandchildren too. Because right now, it's kind of the idea, if it doesn't work out, I'll just get a divorce, It's no longer till death do us part, but it's as long as love shall last. And after all, if I have a roommate in college and I don't like the roommate, I get another roommate. If I have a roommate when I'm out in the workaday world, I get a new roommate. If the husband or wife doesn't work out, I get another spouse. Well, what we found is, first of all, this. After doing this longitudinal study for 25 years in Marin County, she concluded that as she looked at these couples that got divorced, that 3 out of 5 children felt rejected by at least one parent. So the idea that maybe we can have an amicable divorce, are there some out there? Certainly there are. Does Hollywood make it sound like all of them are? Unfortunately, yes, but isn't as amicable as we will find out. Found that many of them still felt rejected by a parent. 5 years after the divorce, more than a third of the children were doing markedly worse than they had been before the divorce. And I'm going to give you some facts on that in the next slide in just a minute. Half grew up in settings in which the parents were warring with each other even after the divorce. The idea, let's get them out of the house, then we won't hear the constant conflict, but the conflict doesn't really go away, does it? And again, if you've been through a divorce, you know that in some of these facts that were surfaced by Judith Wallerstein are certainly indeed the case. Let's look at the issue to the children. And again, a lot of this is documented in the book, which you're making available to some of our various visitors. But again, we can think of those as the 3 E's of the impact that it has on children. The first is the emotional impact. This was completely shocking to Judith Wallerstein. She found that as she talked to adult children of divorce, recognized that in some cases these children had, maybe their parents divorced when they're 15. This is now 25 years later. These are 40-year-olds, and they're still feeling the emotional scars from what happened 25 years before. Everybody up until these studies were thinking, it's in a momentary crisis. It's acute, but it's not chronic. What they found is, there are long-lasting emotional scars. So first of all, the emotional impact, even not only for the children, but for the adult children of divorce. Number 2, the educational impact, very significant. They did poor in school, exhibit various behavioral problems. As she looked at this 25-year study, she finally concluded that actually divorce is almost like dropping your child 1 grade level. In other words, they actually fall behind almost 1 grade level in terms of what they've actually gone through. So emotional impact, educational impact, and then the economic impact. As we have said many times on different radio programs, I've said in many of my commentaries, one of the greatest ways, perhaps one of the most effective ways to prevent going into poverty is be married to someone else. If you have a child out of wedlock and never have a husband, or you have a husband but he leaves, again, not due to any fault on your own, single moms are 5 times more likely to be poor than the general population. So again, these are some issues to really begin to think about, especially as we want to craft policies. I don't know that we're ever going to go to a point where we're going to change any of our no-fault divorce laws, but nevertheless, these are things to think about. If you're a parent or a grandparent to share with your kids, if you're a pastor, this is one of the reasons I was at Kennecott this week talking to future pastors, why I get to teach at Dallas Seminary at Temple Baptist and occasionally Southwestern and some of that. I just want them to know this because if nothing else, we need to warn people to recognize that some of the ideas we have about divorce that come from Hollywood are not biblical. And so if you find yourself saying, okay, I want to read a little bit more, I want to check those footnotes, you know, is that really the best research that Kirby's done and all kinds of things, you can certainly get a copy of the book, but more importantly, just go to the website probe.org. Whole weeks of radio programs on things, divorce, cohabitation, marriage, various things that we have now learned in terms of what actually makes marriage more effective. And I think, if nothing else, it just illustrates again that when the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 7 was addressing this issue of divorce, in many ways we find ourselves today dealing with some of the very same issues in the 21st century. So let's be good in speaking the truth about marriage to our culture, and let's recognize that even today, people who would not necessarily agree with us theologically nevertheless have to agree that divorce is not good for families and marriage, and as I will talk about in future times, cohabitation is dangerous as well. If you want to increase your likelihood of being divorced, live together before marriage. Other studies done by David Popino and Barbara Dafoe Whitehead at Rutgers University, again, people that cannot sign the doctrinal statement of Prestonwood Baptist Church, have concluded that if you live together before marriage, you increase your likelihood of being divorced by an additional 50%. So we have people in the secular world now saying what pastors and even various people like Howard Hendricks at Dallas Theological Seminary have been saying for decades. So it's good news, but we need to share that good news with others. Parker?